You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2016 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. I remember staying out in a rented house in Joshua Tree right at the turn of the millennium, and you know the way when you're a guest in a house, you pull books off the shelf, and I plucked off the shelf a book whose title attracted me, Paris Trance, by someone named Jeff Dyer. I started to read it. I didn't know if I was reading a novel or nonfiction, and it really didn't seem to matter. What I was drawn to was the author's voice and his hilarious and ultimately unsuccessful search for, quote, the ultimate experience by means of sex, travel, and drugs. Whoever this author, Jeff Dyer, was, he was eager to take it all in, to travel, to fall in love, to meet new people, to both savor and to complain, yes, about the world. And perhaps you also remember your first encounter with Jeff Dyer's writing, or perhaps it might even be tonight. Jeff Dyer's works combine fiction, autobiography, travel writing, cultural criticism, literary theory. He's uncomfortable with labels of genre, as you'll see in his newest book, The Elegant and Witty White Sands, Experiences from the Outside World, which he'll discuss tonight with another great writer, Jonathan Lethem. White Sands, Experiences from the Outside World, addresses some classic Jeff Dyer questions. Why do we visit particular places? Why do we plan trips to see Buddhist caves in India or northern lights in Greenland? Is it because we want to be overwhelmed? Because we want to flood our senses with meaning? And what if that doesn't happen? How long will those places last after we're gone? And how long will we last? How much time do we have? Several of Dyer's pilgrimages in White Sands are written from the vantage point of his new home, our city, Los Angeles. He goes to Watts Towers, to the home of an emigre writer from Europe who lived in Brentwood. Some are further afield, to the Forbidden City in Beijing, to Robert Smithson's Spiral Jetty in Utah, to French Polynesia to write about Gauguin. You may not be sure exactly what it is Jeff Dyer's looking for, and he may not be sure either. His journeys, he says, mark ways in which he tries, quote, to work out what a certain place means, what it's trying to tell us, what we go to it for. Jeff Dyer is a native of Cheltenham, England. His father was a sheet metal worker, and his mother worked in a school canteen. His first book was a study of the English writer John Berger, followed by a novel, The Color of Memory, and then But Beautiful, a series of short pieces about jazz that effectively began, to quote the Paris Review, the sort of genre demolition for which Dyer is now well known. Since then, he's published several books classified as novels, including The Search, Paris Trance, and Jeff in Venice, Death in Varanasi, and eight that are not. These latter include The Missing of the Sum, A Meditation on World War I, Out of Sheer Rage, In the Shadow of D.H. Lawrence, Yoga for People Who Can't Be Bothered to Do It, my favorite title, The Ongoing Moment, a book on photography, and Zona, a book about a film about a journey to a room. Jeff Dyer is currently writer-in-residence at USC. Jonathan Lethem is the author of 9 novels, 5 short story collections, 6 nonfiction books, and an array of essays published in such publications as Rolling Stone, The New Yorker, and Harper's. His novel, Motherless Brooklyn, won the National Book Critics Circle Award, and among his other books are Fortress of Solitude, Girl in Landscape, Chronic City, and Dissident Gardens. Jonathan grew up in a commune in North Gowanus, in pre-gentrified Brooklyn. His mother was a political activist. His father was an avant-garde painter. His newest novel, A Gambler's Anatomy, is due out this fall. Jonathan is a MacArthur Fellow and currently the Roy Edward Disney Professor of Creative Writing and Professor of English at Pomona College. We're going to begin tonight with a reading by Jeff Dyer. Please welcome Jeff Dyer and Jonathan Lethem to the stage of the LA Public Library.
I think Oh, we've gone wrong. I start up here. Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. Hi, everyone. Thank you for coming. And we thought the best way to set this up was for me to read a little bit of this my latest blockbuster. I was so keen to add a. Oh yeah. Let's give it a bit more. Let's see what it's got in it. Louise was quite keen that I read a bit about Los Angeles, but I figure, you know, we're here in Los Angeles and you know all about that. So let's enjoy the fact that we're in this sunny place, and I'm going to read a bit about the ill-fated trip that my wife and I did to try to see the Northern Lights in Svalbard in Norway. And really, there's no context needed, except that we arrive at this place way up in the sort of Arctic Circle in the middle of January. And it's, of course, very cold and very dark. Perfect conditions for seeing the Northern Lights. After our trip to the supermarket, we'd set out for dinner as though making an assault on the summit of K2. For a morning's dog mushing, however, more serious kit was required. 3 pairs of socks, thermals, 2 t-shirts, a lumberjack shirt, a thick sweater, a woolen hat, gloves, and an enormous parka. This was my underwear. A van picked us up at the hotel and took us through the awful darkness to the large Expedition HQ, where we hauled on snow suits, full-face balaclavas, snow goggles, snow boots and mittens. Suited and immensely booted, barely able to move, we got back in the van and drove on to the dog yard. There were 6 of us, Jessica and me, a Romanian couple who had immigrated to Denmark, and our 2 guides, Birgitta and Yeti. Yeti, I said. What an abominable name. The entrance to the dogyard was marked by seal skins hanging on a triangular gallows like a frosty modern artwork in the style of a skeletal wigwam. There were 90 dogs there, 90 Alaskan huskies, chained and yelping in the urine-stained and poo-smeared ice of the compound. Light, fences and snow all contributed to the impression that we'd stumbled into some kind of canine gulag. Not that the doggies were unhappy or unloved. They were chomping at the bit, straining at the leash. Every dog has its day, and each and every one of them hoped that this would be his or hers. And that wasn't all that was going on. Implausible though it seemed in such icy conditions, the females somehow were in heat, and the males were desperate to get their paws on them. To us, they were friendly rather than randy, as cuddly as anything, but the yelping was like the soundtrack of a doggy nightmare. They had lovely names, the dogs, Junior, Ivory, Yukon, and, though I may have got this wrong, Tampax, were among the lucky ones chosen to go out with us on this night that was indistinguishable from deepest day. Although it was dark, I could see the huskies' strange eyes, so pale and milky clear that they seemed independent of the bodies in which they were lodged, planets in a dog-shaped universe. Presumably, these eyes meant that the dogs had night vision, could see for miles in the deepest night. I was surrounded by these eyes, cold and flashing with a clarity that seemed devoid of intelligence or even life. Part of our job, part of the day's advertised fun, even though just as what was called day was really deep night, so this fun was pure misery, was to take the selected dogs, put them in harness, and fix the harness to the sled, slick 6 dogs per sled. The yelping was driving me insane, and my toes were already numb with cold. Because I was thinking of my numb toes and constantly checking that not an inch of my flesh was exposed, I was not listening properly to the instructions about how to put on the harnesses, and it was not easy to hear anyway, with my parka and snowsuit hood pulled up and my head full of the sound of the yelping of 90 Alaskan huskies, half of them in heat and all of them desperate to run or fuck or both. Saddling up the three teams of dogs took ages, partly because with these multiple layers of clothes squashed under one's snowsuit, it was possible to move only at the speed of a deep-sea diver. I'm tall anyway, but with all this clobber, I loomed like death itself in the polar night. Death be not proud. I got into such a tangle with the numerous, often inexplicable bits of harness and rope and the dogs all leaping over each other that I slipped onto my back, landing on the hard ice, which, through all these layers of clothing blubber, felt as soft as a piss-streaked sponge cake. There is a lesson to be learned from this. In the depths of the darkest night and the darkness of the deepest cold, mankind's need for slapstick will never be quite extinguished. Eventually, we were saddled up and ready to go. Whenever we hire a car, Jessica always steers us out of the parking lot for the first few tentative miles, when we're unsure of the controls and the chances of an accident are at their peak. On this occasion, though, I was driving. I said that she should take the reins, but she insisted that this was my manly prerogative and plonked herself down in the sled on a comfy-looking piece of blue rug. A few moments later, we were off. First team out, second team out, and then us bringing up the rear in suddenly hot pursuit. The huskies meant business, there was no doubt about that. I still had the sled's anchor in my hand, was struggling to hook it to the side of the sled so that it would not impale Jessica's head like a fishing hook in the cheek of a giant human fish. An extraordinary amount of speed had been abruptly unleashed, unharnessed by even a modicum of control. We were charging downhill at an angle, so we had to lean into the slope to avoid capsizing. Through my hood, I could still hear the dogs yelping, though by now my head was so full of yelping, this might have been the residue of the old yelping of the dogs in the compound, not the ecstatic yelping of huskies galloping through the Arctic dark. It was hard work steering the sled, hard enough to make me sweat. It felt good being hot, but sweating was not good at all, because as soon as this exertion was over, the sweat would freeze. We were zooming along, plunging down a slope. I lost control of the sled, over which I'd never had the slightest control anyway, and tumbled off the back into deep snow. The sled spilled over, but the anchor, which was supposed to serve as a brake, had not been deployed, and the huskies did not stop. They'd not been released from captivity in order to have their outing curtailed at this early stage. Even through my hood, I could hear Jessica yelling, "Stop!" She was dragged for 50 metres, tangled up beneath the sled, and, for all I know, had the anchor embedded in her skull. As I ran after her, with no thought in my head except her welfare, I was silently forming the words, "I said you should have driven first." It took ages to get the attention of the other teams because they'd zoomed off even faster than we had. But eventually, Birgitta and Yeti came back and pulled the sled off Jessica. She was uninjured, but sufficiently shaken up to declare that she did not want to go on. We were all standing with our breath creating little snowstorms in the light of our headlamps, busy disentangling all the reins and dogs which had got into the most incredible tangle. I say we, but I just stood there really, doing nothing, sweating and breathing heavily, worrying that if I exerted myself further, I would end up entombed like the Frankenstein monster in a glacier of frozen sweat. Actually, I did try to do something. I tried to take pictures of what I referred to as the crash site, but my camera had frozen. Everything about this environment was quite unsuited to photography, human habitation, tourism, or happiness. Jessica had had enough too, was persuaded to continue only on condition that she was driven by Yeti or Birgitta, and not, as she put it, by that idiot. "She's in shock," I said. "She doesn't know what she's saying." I had no desire to drive either, so we both ended up as passengers, each on a sled driven by one of the guides. We made much better progress like this. And it wasn't pitch black, I could see now. There was a glimmer of dark light around the dark contours of the mountains, or whatever they were, and a glimmer of stars. But the overwhelming impression was still that there was nothing to see. My toes were numb, but despite my fears about freezing sweat, I was surprisingly warm, especially when I discovered that the blue rug Jessica had been sitting on was actually a kind of mini sleeping bag, and I was able to add yet another of insulation. Bundled up like this, like a frozen mummy, it was quite fun barreling through the barren wastes, especially since there was a suggestion of light in the sky, even if, by any normal definition of the phrase, it was still pitch dark. Oh, and I'd come to love the Huskies. Irrespective of what the job entails, I love anyone, man or beast, who does their job well. And these Huskies, whose job was to pull a sled, were absolute in their huskiness. From reading about Amundsen's expedition to the South Pole, I knew that, if the going got tough, the Huskies could be fed to each other. Yeti kept up a lovely sing-song of instruction and encouragement, which, for all I knew, constantly reminded the dogs of this fact, that the weak would become food for the less weak. So has it always been. So will it always be. Since she was singing, I started singing too. One of the cadence songs from Full Metal Jacket. I don't know, but I've been told. I don't know, but I've been told Eskimo pussy is mighty cold. And then I thought of the film Atanagerat, The Fast Runner, which, among its many other virtues, hotly refutes this claim. My mind was wandering, but it kept coming back to the immediate reality, which was that we were out in the open air, in pitch darkness. The brief period when a glimmer of light appeared on the horizon had already come to an end, was no more than a memory now. So we were still here in freezing conditions and the northern lights were nowhere to be seen. So that's the end of that section. Thank you. So now we move. It's a wonderfully orchestrated evening, isn't it?
So, I'm Jonathan, obviously. That's Jeff. And the first thing I think I want to do is tell a little story about Jeff, since he's been properly introduced already. And now I'll do the improper introduction. So, Jeff and I have had a lucky friendship, an odd friendship, consisting of only seeing one another in exotic locales, accidentally at book festivals or weddings. We've never really had the chance to visit in a normal way, but we're always ending up somewhere. And that means that I have because Jeff is a superb writer on no subject whatsoever, you can always hope to be written about, because he might decide you're the next, Sled Dog or D.H. Lawrence or obscure Russian film. And so I'm always waiting to appear, because here I've already got the exotic location in hand, because we're always being sent to exotic locations. So I was with Jeff at the best exotic location we'd managed, which was Singapore for a book festival. And on the very first day, we saw each other and embraced in the hotel, and we were very excited. And Jeff said, Interstellar just opened. You want to go? So we rushed off in a cab, and Jeff navigated very brilliantly. There was no problem at all. We didn't end up in an accident. We got to a movie theater in Singapore and rushed in and bought tickets to see Interstellar, an American film we could have seen in any city in the world, and that had nothing to do with the interest and the excitement of being in Singapore. And we were very excited and self-congratulatory, because we were obviously in a Jeff Dyer anecdote at this moment. We were choosing to do the one thing that was not distinctive in the distinctive place. And so I thought, I've made it. I'm going to appear as the companion in the Singapore was it was a extremely hot afternoon, and we rushed past all this fascinating local culture and possible encounters with the real textures of a foreign city into a completely generic multiplex, and it was refrigerated. It was ice cold. That's why I thought of it, because of all the gear in that story. Jeff knows where I'm going now.
Yeah.
So I thought, I you know, we've got the exotic location. We've got the ironic reversal. We're definitely in a Jeff Dyer experience at this moment, and we have the pithy observation, which is that we could have done this anywhere. But what I didn't realize was that there were missing pieces, and the butt of the joke was the missing piece. Because when I heard Jeff finally telling this story, he didn't write it down, but I heard him telling it at a dinner party. The whole point of the story wasn't what I thought was clever about it. It was that in this terrible three-hour movie, in an ice-cold movie theater, he'd brought a nice layered sweater or sweatshirt, and I was just in a t-shirt. And he could tell that when Matt Damon was on the icy planet, that I was absolutely frigid in the movie theater, and that he felt very happy and very, very pleased with himself because he'd brought an extra layer. That was when it was really a complete Jeff Dyer story, because it included the Schadenfreude and the humble bragging. But what I'm really meaning to say is, you have an extraordinary capacity to bring us into experiences that are both exotic and completely human, and to present yourself as a witness and a character, a figure of fun, slapstick even. You know, in so many different kinds of occasions, literary occasions, artistic encounters like the one with the Tarkovsky film, or your book on photography, or the book on jazz. And it's such an incredible gift, because your erudition is worn so lightly, and you guide us into so many interesting situations that we learn things without knowing that we're doing so. And we're always laughing. We're always enjoying this voice. I also think that where I want to begin our conversation is to ask you about something that fascinates me, which is how present and invisible you are simultaneously in your books, because you've never written, so far as I know, anything that's really particularly confessional or memoiristic.
Yeah.
One is always encountering Jeff, mm-hmm. or Jeff, and yet you're also always sort of an usher standing to one side as other things are rolled out and presented. So a question that has occurred to me out of real curiosity is what you were like as a child. Because it's something that no one reading your books, as much as you might come to feel, as I've come to feel, and I think there are probably people here who've read as many of your books as I have, feel that we know you very well. It occurred to me, I have no idea, because you've never said word one. I mean, I found a reference in this book to pub crawling when you were a teenager. Let's see, I'll read this couple of lines. Completely different to how things were for me in Cheltenham, when trying to meet girls meant going to a disco, drinking a gallon of beer, only speaking to your mates, and getting punched in the face on the walk home, often by one of these mates, for reasons that were never entirely clear, though beer obviously played a part. And that's it. You glance, and then you glance away again. But I'm wondering if you could talk about how you first encountered books, and how you first encountered jazz and photography and art, and when you conceived that you were going to want to bring yourself into the relation to them that you are now.
Yeah, God, there's so much. This is all so interesting to me. I mean, but I'm actually going to go back to that anecdote in Singapore and say the reason that I haven't written about it, isn't there some kind of etiquette that if you hadn't been you, if you hadn't been a writer, I almost certainly would have written that up. But isn't it a bit rude to sort of lay claims to an experience when there's another writer around? I find that a little bit inhibiting. And I know when I went on this sort of tour with a bunch of other writers, and it was, we were having amazing experiences, but I felt so inhibited that I just couldn't feel like a writer. I didn't take a single note because I was conscious that other people were. So that's a that's something we might come back to.
Yeah.
The memoir question is extremely interesting because my wife, Rebecca, keeps saying that I should write a memoir because my childhood actually is quite interesting, only because it's so completely sort of ordinary in a way, but it's an experience of a sort of nearly vanished world now. I've written a little bit about this in essays, like there's that essay on being an only child. So that's what... You know, that's the key thing, that I didn't have any brothers or sisters. So, how many only children are in the room? Yeah. So, in a shame, actually, it's a shame in a way, Jonathan, now that you've asked this question, it's a shame that you're not Billy Collins, who was originally going to be doing the interview, because he's an only child.
He's an only child.
And we just bonded so quickly when we met, and he came up with this great... definition of what it meant to be an only child, which was, he said, great, my turn again. And that was, that really, there's such a sort of truth there. So as a only child, I was incredibly bored a lot of the time, especially when my dad was working nights and we had to be very, very quiet. And obviously I had lots of friends. We lived in a very kind of convivial little neighborhood, but there was always a point when I'd have to go back home, and whereas other kids like you, or, you know, all of the rest of you with brothers and sisters, you'd go back to this, you know, hubbub of quarreling and crying and, you know, playing and disobedience. If you're an only child, you just go back to this thing of you and your mum and dad. And for me, not only that, but no pets either. So it was just, yeah, it really is. It's oh, and there were no cousins of my age either. And you can see where I'm going with this. And it was a house also without any books.
You're seeking pity? Is that...
Always, yeah. But being an only child, you see, I'm used to providing the pity myself. So self-pity. But, I mean, in a way, then, what I've described is, you know, I'm all the conditions for an eventual falling in love with books, although that didn't happen till much, you know, much later when I was kind of 14, 15, something like that. And then this really, you know, it's the classic story, which I sort of, you know, there's a teacher at school who makes me fall in love with reading. And we had this kind of thing where we were doing Richard III at school, you know, and so it was, you know, got Shakespeare. And this strange thing happened. So my mum worked at the school canteen. And then, in a way that was not at all unusual back then, there was another of these dinner ladies, you know, working class lady, but who had this love of culture, if you like, if you can call it that. And she had this record of Richard III, Richard III being played, I can't remember by which one, either Peter Cushing or Christopher Lee. And, you know, I'd listened to that all the time, and then, and just became a big reader, really, because, you know, the lonely only child has all that sort of time on his or her hands. So that's how...
Did you read novels?
Yeah. The great thing about my teacher was that, as well as getting us into Shakespeare and Chaucer, you know, all that sort of stuff, he also got us reading... not exactly contemporary, but recent things. And I really loved Kerouac, Salinger, Joseph Heller. And the strange thing for me is that those American writers felt so much more contemporary to me than English writers who were actually, whose dates were the same as them. And then the other thing, of course, independently, and this is one of our many areas of overlapping interest, you know, I just in the local shop, I, you know, discovered American superhero comics. Mm. So they were a massive part of my childhood.
Who were your favorites?
Oh, Spider-Man.
Yeah.
So it was that. I think it's really, and it was the other thing I should say about it was so incredibly sort of localized, really. So, We rarely went on holiday, this kind of stuff. I didn't go on a plane till I was 22 or 23. Yeah. And this is why Rebecca thinks I should write about it, because it's not that long ago, but it's a way of life which is sort of
the insularity. When did you conceive of yourself as a writer?
Well, I still don't. At some deep vocational level, I don't. I sort of still don't. And I certainly. I mean, I wasn't determined to become a writer. I just became one sort of accidentally. In that, I know when we've spoken before about your life as an essayist, where you've said, no, it was a sideline.
Right.
On that thing of being a novelist, whereas for me it was the exact opposite. I began writing book reviews, wrote longer book reviews, and then pieces for magazines, and then just gradually became a writer of books. So although, retrospectively I could claim, yes, I always wanted to be a writer, but really there were so many other things that I always wanted to be.
Were you expecting to be an academic, do you think? Or?
No, I really wasn't, because that was so, after the incredible influence of this teacher at school who'd so transformed my life, and I went to Oxford, where you're really at the mercy of your tutor at Oxford, who you see for once a week, and he made it so plain to us within about 3 weeks that teaching us was just an irritating intrusion on his time. It was a deeply disillusioning experience, but at the same time, that Oxbridge style of tuition where you see your tutor once a week and then you just do the reading on your own, I see that it's set up like that just so they don't have to do any work. But at the same time, it really does give you the tools for an ongoing project of self-education that lasts you for a lifetime, so that, I can't see why anyone ever goes to any evening class ever, except for wanting to make friends or maybe romance. But in terms of being able to find out about stuff, it means that, and I think we're similar like this in that, our adult lives have been so much a thing of sort of ongoing self-education, haven't they?
Yeah. So you've just said the name Rebecca when you mentioned your wife, and you've also read to us, and her name was Jessica. And I'm interested in, this is, of course, one of the places our conversation is most personal for me, is in talking about your relationship to fiction making and to the novel and to genre, because I've drifted into nonfiction. And also because this is a time, I think, with, after David Shields' Reality, Hunger Manifesto, and I don't know, there's sort of an anti-novel atmosphere right now with authors like Knausgård or Teju Cole, many others, being celebrated for, in a way, for, Sheila Hedy is another one, interrogating the authority of the novel by filling it with truth, with memoir or reportage instead. You have never stopped working on a version of fiction, and when you do, I don't think you're really an anti-novelist. I mean, I don't think you've looked to topple the form. It's more a sense that you sort of tease at it. But I wonder if you can talk about what you're doing with fiction and what in this book you're doing with that suggestion of fiction, which hovers over the book.
Yeah, I mean, we're really now sort of moving to the heart of things, aren't we? Well, I mean, one thing is for sure. The David Shields book is subtitled a manifesto, and I'm certain everything that I've done in my writing life has definitely not been a sort of any part of a manifesto, and I've not. I've not been a kind of a knocker down of things. There's been nothing iconoclastic, but what I have always been conscious of is of having rather limited interests and abilities novelistically, and so other stuff has to sort of come in to make up for those weaknesses. And this is something I've said before. I've become absolutely convinced, though, for me, that that debate about fiction, non-fiction, just at the level of did it happen, didn't it happen, really only gets you so far. And I mean, for me, what's interesting is this idea of form and the expectations that readers bring to certain forms. You know, you see a book packaged and presented in a certain way, you expect it to behave in a certain way. And I think one of the things, one of the reasons why, I mean, God, writers are always looking for excuses. I think one of the reasons that some people have been disappointed by my books is simply because they're not behaving as expected to. But I think on their own terms, they're behaving quite nicely. And the reason the book is called White Sands is because the central piece, you know, that's the title piece in the book. And it seems to me that that issue of, you know, God, what is it that we're reading is so, it's so sort of important to it. Because at one point, they pick up a hitchhiker, and the hitchhiker tells a story, and the narrator, who's really just me, you know, I mean, stops listening to the hitchhiker because it's a bit boring, and he says, actually, you know, he really wasn't a very good storyteller. He kept bringing in all sorts of irrelevant detail, and of course, that's a kind of self-diagnosis of this story, because according to some sort of classic, let's say, New Yorker kind of template of how a story is meant to proceed, this one is a very bad bit of storytelling. It's bringing in all sorts of irrelevant detail. And it is, as much as it's a story, it's also a kind of essay about that Taryn Simon exhibition of photographs called The Innocents. They pick up this hitchhiker in a place where a sign has said, do not pick up hitchhikers because detention facilities are in the area. And they keep trying to establish, you know, is this guy an unlucky hitchhiker who's just unfortunately thumbing a lift at a place where there's no chance of getting a lift, or is he somebody who has got out of a detention facility? You know, in other words, you know, is he sort of innocent or guilty? Is he telling the truth? Is he lying? So embodied within that story, which is, you know, is it fiction? Is it a story? Is that, you know, is the truth? So there's all sorts of multiple kind of representations replications of these questions. And I think one of the interesting things about that story is, you know, if the reader asks him or herself, God, well, you know, what am I reading here? And what are the kind of, you know, what are the signs? You know, there's a sign here saying don't pick up hitchhikers, but yeah, what are the signs that are telling me what sort of thing this is? And I think that's, I mean, and just to really do this to death, you know, when you go into White Sands, as many of you know, you drive into it on the road, then the road gradually dissolves, you know, and the road, you know, a road trip is inherent narrative, and eventually the road sort of dissolves into all that which is not road. And I like this kind of thing. I certainly don't want to be on that sort of the two-lane blacktop idea of the novel, or the bicycle race novel, as Kundera calls it.
Yeah, but what's interesting to me is that you don't, you know, you said you're not interested in manifestos, and you don't seem to play with lying in memoir or truth-telling in fiction as a provocation. You do it more as a form of abiding with material that can only be evoked for you by this indeterminacy. And so the reader's invited in to be in this indeterminate space with you rather than provoked to challenge you know, sorting it out one way or the other.
I couldn't put it any better myself. Yeah, it's really not. There's no sort of provocation in it. I like the idea of some sort of abiding with it. That is to say, I like the idea of the reader being a bit patient and of not throwing it aside because it's not conforming to some pre-existing idea that the reader might have of what they want the experience to be. Always, it's, I mean, you know, going right back, the books have, have really wanted to be, you know, to be read on their own terms. And I keep going back to this. I went through a phase of eliminating, during various reissues, for example, I would eliminate the subtitles of the nonfiction books just to try to stop them being defined in that nonfiction-y way by the subject matter. And then, you know, then I realized that was a daft idea, so I bring the subtitle back. But yeah, that, you know, so it's all, yeah, it's been a constant thing for me. But you're absolutely right. It's not, there's no kind of adolescent trying to just, you know, offend the parents kind of thing.
So before terribly much longer, I'm going to be inviting audience questions, but before I do, let me pursue what you tried to slip the bonds on with Louise's invitation to read about Los Angeles and ask you about being here. Okay. And I mean, it's one of the subject matters of this book, I think, is this arrival on this coast and in America in a different way than you'd been in America before. And so I'd like to ask you, I guess, about the journey to the Watts Towers, for instance, which you knew first as an emblem on the Don Cherry album cover, right?
Yeah.
So had you wanted to come see those towers? Had you understood what they were when you saw them on that album?
Oh, when I saw them on the album cover, I had absolutely no idea what they were, because they also look rather different on the album cover to how they do in real life. And I guess, I mean, there's a number of things going on in the book. There's the Watts Towers, there's the Lightning Field, the Spiral Jetty. And I guess, so two of those things are completely respectable, sort of art historical kind of things. The other's this sort of rogue, you know, eccentric thing. But I think they were, you know, they formed a kind of unity in that for me, that I came to them all I didn't come to any of them via art, but via sort of marks made on the landscape.
Spatial encounter for you.
Yes, exactly that. And you know, it seems to me that in some ways that the Lightning Field, you go there to experience it as a work of art is probably I'm not sure one is doing justice to it like that. It seems to me it's got more, for me it seemed to have more in common with visits I'd made to kind of sacred places, let's say, or ancient sites like Stonehenge, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. And then equally with the Watts Towers, you know, there's this kind of thing of, you know, people can't wholeheartedly allow it into the pantheon of, you know, serious artworks because it's too eccentric. But I think there's another, even trying to sort of ask for it to be admitted into the pantheon of art is again to perhaps not do it justice. There's something else going on there. But I guess the thing that's uniting all of these places for me is that I always like it when I come to a place and I feel that there is some kind of obvious power emanating from and converging on it. That is the, that's something that I'm always kind of on the lookout for as an experience, and it's something which writing wise I've always been, you know, I've always found it interesting to try to articulate precisely what was going on.
It seems to me, the biggest difference between being in Europe or being in the British Isles and being in California is you're in a place where it's not just that there's so much more space, but the claims upon it are so much more tenuous and recent and provisional. Mm. And, you know, this book with the journey to White Sands and the journey to these different sort of sacred spaces or invented destinations like the Spiral Jetty, and even the polar expedition, you know, that you were just describing, there's this sense of wondering what it is to claim space. And when you write about Gauguin going to Tahiti and what it means for him to be there, and then you journey there, and your concern seems to be, was it already claimed or ruined? Was the ocean domesticated after, you know, did Gauguin have an experience that wasn't available anymore for you when you went to Tahiti? Mm. So I wonder how you respond to Los Angeles as a space that's in a way still being invented or contested.
Yeah, well, it's an exciting place in that regard. And I think that there's this kind of the kind of paradox that this, you know, paradigmatic city without a history has got a lot of history here, but in a way that's very appealing to somebody from Britain, where, you know, it's every building has a blue plaque on it. It's like, oh yeah, here's Chaucer's house and Shakespeare lived right next door in this kind of, the history of in Los Angeles is not at all preserved. So one of the pieces in the book is about going to, to visit the house where Adorno lived. And the greatness of that experience is so bound up with the fact that there isn't a blue, what in England would be a blue plaque saying here lived, highly serious German philosopher who wrote Minima Moralia. That would just the way that it's just this regular, unremarked on house that people mainly just zoom past is, I like that very much. And then at anyone, whatever your particular interest is, it seems to me here, a whole load of other doors open up. And then, of course, I became interested in this whole kind of extraordinary phenomenon of all these German émigrés living, living on each other's doorsteps in this culture that they, every element of their formation had led them to so thoroughly despise. It's crass, it's commercial, populist, money-driven, it's not serious, then it becomes this, and then the supreme irony, of course, is that in some ways writing scores for films becomes one of the few viable kind of sort of preserves for sort of modern classical serious music.
And Thomas Mann was out here for a while.
He's in the Pacific. He was living in the Pacific Palisades, and as I'm sure Adorno was Mann's musical advisor for Dr. Faustus, and then I discovered that something like, wouldn't it have been great if we could have turned up at Adorno's house, and just said, could we come in for tea, I don't know what sort of reception we'd got, but then I discovered this extraordinary thing that, Susan Sontag had done exactly that as a 14-year-old when, she was so in love with the author of The Magic Mountain. Her friend, looked up Thomas Mann's address and sort of said, I've got this brainy friend called Susan. She really, really likes your work. Could we come round? And so they go and have tea with Thomas Mann. So then in that rather nice way, my thing about Adorno also becomes a kind of thing, a sort of little, not exactly a pilgrimage, but a homage to Sontag.
And the people living in Adorno's house right now don't...
The woman that we saw had a vague... Initially, we said, we're here. We knocked on the door. She answered very nicely. And she sort of said the philosopher, and she, of course, invited us in that totally unparanoid way. There was no Adorno memorabilia to steal or anything like that. And then rather at the end, she just, and we chatted, and then and then she just came out with this wonderful line, which I didn't make up as we left. She said, just remind me, how do you spell Adorno again? there was just something so sort of, it was, and then there was another way in which it was very present, because I met this actor that some of you may know called Norman Lloyd, this very old man who turned 100 last year, and I'd met him, so I called him up and said, did you ever, and he knew everybody, he used to play tennis with Charlie Chaplin, and I said, do you ever know Adorno? And he's got this rather fruity voice. He said, no, but I knew Brecht rather well. So it's sort of, it's there that, and of course, geez, you've got this long tradition as well of these British people living there, think of Isherwood down the road from me in Santa Monica. Isherwood, who, that's the other thing, you were saying, Jonathan, there's a lot of it around now, this kind of is it fiction, isn't it stuff, but you can always predate it, so you can think of Isherwood and the Berlin stories.
Sure, those and Christopher and his kind, and
exactly
that's that. That's good. I hadn't thought of him in that light. Let me get some other voices into this conversation. I may throw a few questions into the mix yet, but let's hear from some people who want to talk to you. I think.
Sure thing. okay? Mm. Oh, right there in my peripheral vision, yeah.
Hi. Hi. I was wondering how, since you're from England, the food change, how you were able to adapt. Because I have gone to England and it was different.
He's being very polite.
Yeah. Is he being polite? I thought he was... I couldn't quite hear, but it sounded to me like he was saying the food there sucked. Do you know, it's funny. I mean, the food in England is amazing now. For many, many, many years, it was terrible. But it's a kind of... It really is, you know, it's not as good as the food here, of course, because, you know, the food's not as good as it is here anywhere. You know, it's the best place on earth to eat. But, I mean, certainly that claim that the French have that English food is terrible is really obsolete now, because actually the truth is British food is a lot better than French food, which is they call the English roast beef, but the only place you really, you know, the place where they really like to eat beef and two veg is Paris, really, of France, you know. So, yeah, I mean, sympathetic though I am to your point, it wasn't such a, it wasn't quite the shock for me to my system or my tummy that you were suggesting. But thank you for your concern. Yeah.
Good evening. Among all of your travels, I was captivated by what seems to be your affinity to both the West, California, and New Mexico. And I'm wondering about how that came about.
Yeah. Oh, it's very, several things. I think it's entirely natural if you grow up on this little rainy rock in the middle of the Atlantic that you're going to be drawn to those big open spaces that you see in Westerns, you know. Of course, we were talking about how I've ended up just down the road from Isherwood. Well, somebody was really important for me who grew up only about less than 100 miles from where I was born. D.H. Lawrence, of course, comes to New Mexico. The subtitle of this book is derived from his essay on New Mexico, where he'd said it was the greatest experience from the outside world that he'd had, and, you know, something in his soul started opening up, he felt, under that, you know, that vast sky. So I think that's, you know, we're just... It makes total sense. And I think that, for me, the other thing is that one's, you know... So I was saying earlier on that I grew up in this very, very, sort of limited world, but then there's nearly always some window to a larger world. So, and it's there's a little chapter in the book about this. So my mum grew up on this farm, her and her three sisters, one of whom was just so stunningly beautiful. And it just like some sort of Thomas Hardy novel, this stunningly beautiful sister of my mum's came to the attention of this a man at a very expensive, what we in England call public school, a private school. And so she married him, she would have gone into service otherwise, you know, to be a sort of, you know, a maid or something, but led this very different life, moved to London, where she then fell in love. She left her husband and ran off with this self-made millionaire. And they started leading this incredibly exotic life. And they went on a cruise on the QE2 and went on a big road trip of America. And she'd send me back brochures from these national parks with these wonderful photographs of the petrified forest and the painted desert and the Grand Canyon. So important for me, because then these places that I'd seen on, you know, in Westerns, it turns out they were real. So there was that beginning of some sort of beckoning of elsewhere back then, I think. But, you know, you don't need me to tell you that, you know, Los Angeles is full of British people driven here by the, you know... You know, it really is. I mean, honestly, you might be sitting there thinking, geez, that guy has a miserable face. I'm 100% sure it wouldn't be this miserable looking had it not been forced into this configuration by decades of disappointing summers in in Britain. So it's taken its toll on my face and those of my countrymen and women. Thank you. Yeah.
Hello. I recently read an introduction to a book of memoir essays that Annie Dillard, she'd written the introduction, and she was giving advice, I guess, to young writers, and she says, if you have a true story that you want to tell, don't try to disguise it in fiction. And I thought that was a strange bit of advice. It seems like a lot of people do that. And I know that you've talked about not wanting to make the distinction between creative nonfiction and fiction, but I was wondering if you could speak to that idea that she posed about not trying to you know, tell a true story as
yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, Jonathan was saying that I wasn't a provocateur, and I wouldn't want to be perhaps quite as prescriptive as Annie Dillard there. I would say it would depend on it. It's always a question of finding a means of expression that's appropriate to the subject matter or the story or whatever. What I certainly am glad to be free of is that sort of thing whereby you have an experience and you just assume that, oh, this must be novelized. But I certainly don't want to go the other way and say, no, it must not be novelized. It's a question of just finding a form that is doing full justice to the maximum justice to the sort of, what's the phrase, like the expressive potential of that material. So always for me, it's a question of what's appropriate. And the great thing about Annie Dillard is that, yeah, she has just found so many different ways of arriving at a form that's appropriate. One way in which I would be absolutely with her is that, you know, there's a sense in which the idea of certain novels is it's so conventionalized that it could be regarded as a cliche. And as we know, as writers, God, you certainly want to avoid cliches. And it seems to me there are cliches of form as well as of expression. Thank you.
I know this is bad, but being here in Hollywood and at USC with its amazing film school, have there been any temptations like, you know, these people are talking to me about going to Hollywood? Obviously, you're in such a great niche. I hope it doesn't happen, but is that something that has crossed your mind?
God, I like it. It's funny. There they are in the DJ booth, as it were, you know. Yeah, no, I'm glad you've said this, because one of the things that about moving here is that I knew it was going to be very relaxing for me, because I have absolutely no desire at all to write for the movies or television. It's just has no appeal to me. That's not to say that I'm in some Adorno-like way, I think it's inferior, you know, not at all. It's just beyond, all the things that it requires are skills that I don't have. So I knew it would be relaxing for me, because I know I've seen how the torment that people can be subjected to when they're either knocking on the door or when the door seems to be opening. I mean, Jonathan's had this great expression about life here. I mean, I don't even know whether it's original or not. This idea that people, you know, in Hollywood, they can encourage you to death. but yeah, it has no appeal. Although weirdly, coincidentally, within a week of moving here, a European film director whose work I just love approached me to write a script, and my vanity was so flattered that I sort of said, "Oh yeah, I'll have a go." And then I came to my senses the next day and said, "Oh, it's just I was so flattered by your invitation, and then so I didn't do it." But yeah, I just couldn't do it at all. As a result, though, on the one hand, yeah, life is quite relaxing for me here. On the other, it means that there's some sort of sense of belonging that is being missed, because I think you really can feel you belong here if you're writing for you know, for some screen or other.
So I'm sure there's someone else getting ready too, but let me follow on that question a little bit because, I mean, you're distinguishing, obviously, importantly, that you're not tempted by the industry, but on the other hand, you have this incredible passion as a filmgoer, and I know you've written the book on Tarkovsky's Stalker. That might seem sort of an exotic, an exemplary art film in some way, but just before coming in here, we were talking about Lee Marvin films,
yeah.
And you were a guest curator at the Telluride Film Festival, mm-hmm. Is that right? Yeah. So is there a meaning that you're experiencing in being close to the source of this tradition, and do you feel that you're interacting with it in some way by your presence here?
I think actually it's more that I realize, and it's one of the, again, these things that you and I have in common. I mean, I feel that we're such fans in a way. And for me, I realize that, you know, some of the books, I've written this book about jazz, which I love. I don't play a note of music. Written a book about photography, certainly don't take pictures. And, you know, these are all things that I really like to look at, to see or listen to. But always, not as a consumer isn't the right word, but as an appreciator of, and a kind of nerdy, kind of obsessive about, but no desire to cross to the other side of it. And in some superstitious way, I sort of believe that my appreciation, my ability to write about these things is conditional upon my not trying to do them myself. But I am... the Tarkovsky book, I summarized the action of Stalker, and I really have thought about doing some more of this thing of summarizing films, and that Point Blank is certainly a film that I'd like to write something about, because I don't know, maybe it's something that, I mean, I find I just keep coming back to a smallish number of films which really just are so deeply imprinted on me. And we'd imprinted themselves on me, this is important, I think, before I saw Stalker, which completely, you know, transformed my idea of what a film could be. So I'm, yeah, it's Point Blank and Where Eagles Dare. Yeah, which I actually I introduced a screening of that at Telluride a few years ago.
And what are some others?
Those are the two that I see that there's some potential for writing about like that, yeah. I think. Yeah. Yeah.
Is there a last one?
Is there somewhere you haven't been that you really, really want to go?
Yes. Are you the person who has the sort of the first class travel ticket? It's not a particularly exotic or unusual ambition, but it just, like when you say there's a band that you've not heard of before, and then suddenly in the space of a week you hear of this band or this author, and anyway, just in the last year, whenever I've seen a picture of somewhere amazing, it's always been of Iceland, and I just really feel something is drawing me to Iceland, but as yet that sort of invitation with a business class ticket attached has not manifested itself. This is a fundraiser for me tonight, right?
Jeff, thank you for talking with me. And thanks, everyone.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Jonathan.
That's great. Yeah. Of course.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the estate of Suzanne Aaron, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.